Good morning. Welcome to Asia Today with Jeffrey Bingham Mead. I'm so glad that you could join us today. We're coming to you and the world with the miracle of modern technology and the magic of 21st century broadcasting from the renowned studios of Radio 1490 WGCH Greenwich, Connecticut, USA, and WGCH.com anywhere via live streaming over the internet. Our goal is to contribute to global understanding, promote connections in the arts, culture, education, business, public policy, and international exchange, and create opportunities in the spirit of enduring exploration, friendship, and trust, with a focus on the Asia-Pacific region. We've got a great show for you, so without further delay, let's get started.
Coming up on today's show,
my guest on Conversations is Mr. James M. Scott. He's the author of Target Tokyo, Jimmy Doolittle and the Raid That Avenged Pearl Harbor. The Doolittle Raid was launched to avenge the December 7, 1941 attack on Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. President Franklin Roosevelt gathered with his senior military counselors to plan an ambitious, risky counterstrike against the heart of the Japanese Empire, Tokyo. 16 U.S. Army bombers under the command of Jimmy Doolittle lifted off the deck of the USS Hornet. The one-way mission pummeled factories, refineries, dockyards, and other targets in the Japanese capital, and then there was the task of escaping to China. While Roosevelt heralded the raid as a propaganda victory, it came at a heavy price by the Chinese people, who suffered the most victims of a retaliatory campaign by the Japanese army that tragically claimed the lives of an estimated 250,000 Chinese people. This is one of the most exhaustive and detailed narratives of the Doolittle Raid ever assembled, with author James Scott having access to never-before-utilized or published international sources.
Welcome to Conversations with Jeffrey Bingham Mead, your host.
It's my pleasure to welcome James M. Scott. He is the author of Target Tokyo, Jimmy Doolittle and the Raid That Avenged Pearl Harbor. Why did you decide to write a book about the Doolittle Raid?
The Doolittle Raid is without a doubt one of the most fascinating stories of World War II for a couple of reasons. On the one hand, it's the story of, you know, this amazing raid, a virtual suicide mission, which 80 volunteer airmen literally take off on a one-way raid to bomb Japan and escape to free China. But it's also much more than just this one mission. It's really the story of a nation in its darkest hour. And, you know, the wake of the attack on Pearl Harbor, the fall of Singapore, the Philippines are under siege. America really needed a mission, an operation in which it could assure the American public that in the end we would win, that we would be victorious. Mm-hmm. And so this raid really functions on those two levels. It's, on the one hand, it's the story of an incredible mission, incredible operation. But on the other hand, it's really the story of the United States in its darkest hour, yes, desperately in search of heroes.
I was wondering if you would give me and the listening audience, give us an overview of the military and, you know, the geopolitical, you know, circumstances or situation that led to the Doolittle Raid.
Certainly. I mean, the Doolittle Raid really begins on December 7, 1941, with the attack on Pearl Harbor. Yeah. And, you know, the Japanese and the surprise attack there literally destroyed almost half of the American Pacific Fleet. Mm. The country was thrown into a war. And, of course, Pearl Harbor was just the beginning of Japan's acquisitions. You know, they would take Wake and Guam from the United States. Philippines would soon fall. They took Singapore and Hong Kong from the British, the Dutch East Indies from the Netherlands. And so, you know, really this was a pretty terrifying time for America and its allies, because in a short period of time, the Japanese grew an empire that would literally stretch across 20 million square miles.
Yes.
Seven times. So to put it another way, about one-tenth of the world was under the power of Emperor Hirohito.
Yes.
So this was really a very dark time for the United States. You know, and the raid grew out of that, because Roosevelt was really adamant that, you know, he knew that the immediate patriotism that flared up in the wake of the attack on Pearl Harbor would prove short-lived.
Yeah.
And that at the same time, he knew the United States was in no position to go on a sustained offensive.
Mm-hmm.
Take much of 1942, in fact, to enlist and train troops, build the warships, the planes, the bullets, and the rifles. But he knew that the American public's patience wouldn't last that long.
Yeah.
So he had to come up with a way, a symbolic gesture, if you will, to sort of show and assure the American public that we would win.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what the Doolittle Raid was all about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was this way to sort of pull off the unthinkable, a direct attack on the enemy's capital, on its homeland, would send a message not only to the Japanese, but also to the U.S. public. And so that's really kind of the backdrop, if you will, for this incredibly audacious raid.
The central character of your book and of this and of the Doolittle raid, of course, is Jimmy Doolittle. And he is a fascinating individual. And I was wondering if you would tell us about him, how he emerged as the extraordinary military leader that he's remembered as being today.
Absolutely. Yeah. Jimmy Doolittle is without a doubt one of the most fascinating characters of the 20th century. And you know, he's largely remembered for his role in this raid that bears his name, but he was really did so much more than this. I mean, Jimmy Doolittle was he grew up, for example, on the in Alaska, where his father was an unsuccessful gold prospector. He enlisted in the Army during World War I because he wanted to learn how to fly. And so the Army taught him how to fly. He fell in love with it. And he proved so good at it, in fact, that rather than send him overseas to fight, the Army left him home to train others. He once lamented, he said, you know, here I am training all these heroes, and my job, rather than go over and fight, is to stay home and make more heroes.
Yeah.
So, but it was also really the early era of aviation, and that pilots were constantly testing themselves. They were testing their aircrafts, and Doolittle jumped right into the fray. Yeah. He's the first pilot to ever fly cross-country. In less than a day.
It took
22 hours. And, you know, this is the era before GPS. So he literally flew across the country using road maps.
Seriously? Road maps?
Oh, absolutely. And so Doolittle's also the first pilot to ever fly using only instrumentation.
Mm-hmm.
He helped develop the artificial horizon, which is still standard on airplanes.
Wow.
Not only was he courageous and adventurous, he's also brilliant. He earned a master's and a doctorate at MIT.
Wow.
And so, you know, what the raid would require utmost courage and the utmost intellect of American forces. And that's why Doolittle was such a perfect individual to do it, because, you know, he had the intellectual horsepower to figure out how to make this operation work, but he also had the courage to be the one to lead it, to lead this suicide mission. And so that's why, I mean, it's really, you know, he's just the perfect guy to have taken on this task.
He was not the only one, of course, who was involved in the planning and execution of this raid. I was wondering, who were the other leading figures? How did they plan this raid? How did they do that?
Yeah, certainly. You know, what's amazing about this raid, if you really think about what the logistics that went into it, are pretty incredible. And yet it was really pulled off by just a handful of people. And part of that, I think, has to do with the fact that, you know, this was, you know, the United States, sort of when you're cornered and your back is up against the wall, you do some of your best work.
Yes.
And I think this is truly an example of that. Because what they did is, you know, in order to make this raid successful, they had to take long-range Army bombers and take them off from an aircraft carrier, which had never before been done.
Wow.
And so they had to figure out the logistics of, A, whether or not it was even possible for that to happen, and then, B, you know, make it happen. And then they had to configure the airplanes to fly almost twice the distance that they were normally capable of flying. They literally had to double the fuel capacity. So, you know, when you're talking about aviation, you're talking about weight.
Yes.
So if you're adding all of this fuel, then you're having to strip the planes and things like guns and radios, you know, these vital components. And so it really took, you know, the best minds, not only of the Army Air Force, which Doolittle was, but also of the Navy.
Yeah.
And a couple of key figures in the Navy were the Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Ernest King, who was the one who sort of green-lighted this, but also, you know, his subordinates, Francis Lowe and Donald Duncan, who were the ones who sort of, Lowe was the one who came up with the idea. Duncan was the air operations officer for Admiral King.
Mm-hmm.
He's the one who first started looking into logistics, and at that point then they brought in Doolittle.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it wasn't, you know, we ended up using 16 Army bombers. But it's not just a story of, you know, the aviation. You've got to get these planes all the way across the Pacific Ocean in radio silence to Japan's back door. And that requires, you know, 10,000 sailors, 16 warships, you know, including two aircraft carriers. So it is a monumental logistics challenge to pull all of this stuff off. And yet what's amazing is from the time of the attack on Pearl Harbor until the aircraft carrier with Doolittle and his men departs the West Coast, it's only 16 weeks. So just 16 weeks is the amount of time it took pull together this incredible operation.
President Roosevelt, of course, is the president, you know, at this time, and he was under an enormous amount of pressure, as you have said, after the Pearl Harbor attack. So share with us some of what was going on with him at the White House and the cabinet, you know, the government, and the actions that he took, even including that maybe people don't really necessarily know too much about. Yeah,
absolutely. You know, and that's the thing is the raid was the United States, after the attack on Pearl Harbor and after the fall of Guam, Wake, and then the Philippines, the United States had no bases in that region from which to operate.
Yeah.
And to take an American aircraft carrier using Navy planes, which were single-engine planes, which have a very short range, mm-hmm. they would literally have to go up to within about 200 miles of Japan in order to take off and recover those aircraft. It was simply too risky because we only had a handful of aircraft carriers that had fortunately escaped destruction at Pearl mm-hmm. Harbor. And so that was sort of the logistics facing the president at that time.
Yes.
But as a leader like Roosevelt, you know, as a civilian leader, he's less interested in logistics and more with the big picture.
Yes.
So he kept demanding on his senior military leaders to find a way to strike back.
Yeah.
And he was adamant that he didn't want to raid against some far-flung island in the Japanese Empire. He wanted an attack directly against Tokyo, mm-hmm. against the heart of Japan.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the thing about Roosevelt is that he often made these big pronouncements, and then he would leave it up to his senior leaders to figure out how to make it all happen.
Yeah.
And that's a great leader that does that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He keeps his eye on the big picture vision, and he leaves it to his subordinates to figure out, you know, how to enact that. And this was a perfect example of that.
Yeah.
You know, he, and in each of his meetings, if you go and you look at the meeting minutes of and read the diaries and things like that of his cabinet members, you know, every time he would get together with his military leaders, he would be demanding, where are we with the strike on Japan? Where mm-hmm. are we with the strike on Japan?
Yeah.
And so, you know, he really put that pressure on his senior military leaders to find a way to strike back.
Yeah.
He was adamant about it.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, you got to remember, he's not only juggling, you know, the war in the Pacific, it's, you know, he's working with Winston Churchill, who literally moves over from with all of his staff and his senior staff from England over to the White House at the beginning of 1942. You know, they're looking at, you know, the European invasion. So, I mean, at this time, he's trying to sort of manage a global war.
Yes.
And yet, at the same time, he's also keeping, you know, his foot on the gas for his men to find a way to strike back in mm-hmm. the Pacific. So it's really, you can't say enough about the level of pressures and the level of, operations that were literally being built up around the world.
You mentioned that Tokyo was chosen to be the target. It was the heart of the Japanese Empire. But what were some of the particular targets that were hit in Tokyo, in the Tokyo area?
Exactly. They were looking, you know, Doolin was very adamant what they were trying to do, essentially, was they didn't want to inflame, they wanted to drive a wedge between the Japanese government and the military and the civilian public.
Mm.
And in order to do that, they were very adamant that they had to avoid civilian targets.
Yeah.
Because, for instance, Doolittle caught some of his men sort of betting and see who would be the one that would get to bomb the Emperor's Palace. And he put his foot down. He said, we're not going to do that. You know, nothing is going to unite the Japanese people against us.
Exactly.
And if we attack their spiritual figurehead.
Right.
So he was really adamant that his men go after things like steel mills, munitions factories, electrical plants, things that were classic military and industrial targets.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they did then is they took a look at, before the war actually had ever even broken out, American military attachés had gone around to different steel plants and things like that and gotten all their commercial brochures and things like that.
Mm.
They then bought Japanese government maps that kind of, you essentially get it like a filling station.
Mm.
And they had then built these great target maps. Because, you know, you have to remember, there was a lot of tension between the United States and Japan for years leading up to World War II.
Oh, yeah.
We knew at some point we might go to war.
Sure.
So they started the planning process. So when the war actually broke out and the Doolittle Raid was being organized, we just fell back on these resources.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the naval attaché who had done a lot of these bomb-making maps it was actually the intelligence officer on the Hornet, the aircraft carrier that took Doolittle and his men to Tokyo,
uh-huh.
and he personally briefed these guys. And so, you know, there was this great connectivity from making the maps to bringing the bombers all the way over there for this operation.
Mm-hmm.
To take place.
The raid takes place. I wanted to know if you would list for us the immediate and maybe even some of the long-term results of the raid, including if you could share with us what was public, American public and international reaction when the news came out that the raid had taken place.
You have to remember, Tokyo was a huge city at that time, spread across about 200 square miles.
Oh, yeah.
And so we were sending only 16 bombers, each armed with only four bombs.
Mm.
So it's really just a pinball. brick, particularly when you compare that to the latter days of the war when we were flying B-29 raids and we would send 500 bombers a night over Japan. So the raid, despite that, the raid, about 87 people were killed, about 500 more were injured, and the raiders destroyed a little over 100 buildings and damaged them. About as many more. So there, you know, it had consequential effects. But again, looking at the size of Tokyo, looking at the size of the Japanese war machine, it really was not a consequential raid. That said, it was a huge psychological effect for not only the Japanese, but also for the Americans. Mm-hmm. Now, the Japanese at that point, the government and the military had been assuring the Japanese public that it would be an impossibility for the Americans to ever strike back. Mm-hmm. And at that time, there was this incredible euphoria. The Japanese were celebrating all the many victories. And then amid all of that celebration, American bombers appear over the capital city. Mm-hmm. So it has a huge sort of destabilizing effect on the psychology of the Japanese civilian mm-hmm. public.
Yeah.
The American public, the exact same thing. You know, the American public has been reading day after day in their newspapers, listening to the radio, defeat after defeat after defeat, and then suddenly hears this news that American planes have bombed the enemy's capital, and it has this huge euphoria. So much so, too, let me give you an example.
Sure.
I mean, the Jimmy Doolittle becomes this immediate national celebrity, so much so that one town actually went so far as to change its name to Doolittle in his honor. And, you know, a signed war bond poster by Jimmy Doolittle fetched about $4 million in 1942.
Wow.
I mean, that's a staggering amount of money
at that time, yeah.
Exactly. So these guys, you know, it had this huge psychological effect on both sides, and it ultimately led to this huge, you know, battle, if you will, this propaganda battle between the Japanese and the Americans that would stretch on for almost 2 years,
mm-hmm.
sort of both of them trying to control the narrative over the raid.
Sure.
So, you know, it's very fascinating on that.
The raid was successful. The aftermath for the Americans, the luck ran out, basically, as they approached China. I was wondering if you'd share what happened and, you know, how were the Chinese helpful to the American pilots and their crews?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, this is a story in which, you know, I mean, the Chinese are real heroes for the Americans because,
yeah.
you know, the idea was that these guys would never be able to land back on the aircraft carriers. They would have to take off, bomb Japan, and then they were going to fly on to free China, and they were literally going to land on these sort of gravel runways sort of tucked between these mountains.
Mm.
The problem was that these pilots, the task force, was discovered early. The pilots had to take off a couple hundred miles farther than they had originally anticipated,
mm-hmm.
which meant that by the time they made it to China, they were all out of fuel.
Yep.
They were coming in, and not only were they low on fuel, but then the weather deteriorated on them. So they're coming into the middle of these rainstorms.
Mm-hmm.
They had to take off early, so they're coming in at nightfall. So, I mean, everything that could go wrong on that end of it did.
Mm-hmm.
So most of these pilots, all of them either had to bail out and let their planes crash, or they attempted to sort of crash land on these beaches along the Chinese coast. Well, what happened is these pilots ended up spread across about 400 square miles in China.
Yeah.
And a lot of these guys had never been outside of their county, much less their state.
Yeah.
And here they are coming down in a part of the world they know nothing about, which they speak none of the language. And who ultimately rescues them tend to be these Chinese villagers and missionaries,
and
guerrillas, and some nationalist forces as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they have to help these guys essentially make it overland all the way to Chongqing, which was China's wartime capital.
Right.
And they did. And in fact, it's amazing. Out of the raid, there were 80 raiders.
Mm-hmm.
Three of them were killed during the bailout and crash landing.
Yeah.
Eight of them were captured by Japanese forces.
Mm-hmm.
But the rest ultimately made it safely to Chongqing and eventually out of China. Which is pretty astonishing. Out of 80 raiders, 61 of them survived the war.
Incredible.
Which is very incredible. But
yeah.
the Chinese played this really pivotal role for the raiders.
Yes.
And as a result of that, the Chinese paid an awful big price. Yeah, you know, the Japanese were furious about the raid. And they realized that these airfields in China that the raiders had been aiming for were a huge vulnerability, a liability, if you will, for the Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
And so they set out on a campaign, the Japanese Army did, in the summer of 1942. Essentially to eradicate those airfields, but also to punish the locals for having helped out the Americans. And so it was a lot like the sort of Sherman's march through the South during our Civil War.
Oh, yes, yes.
It was a sort of a march of ruin, if you will.
Yeah.
And the Japanese came through and they destroyed villages and towns. Executed some awful atrocities against the villagers. They literally cut people's ears and noses off. They drowned families in wells. They set them on fire. And then in the end, they unleashed bacteriological warfare in the form of plague, anthrax, and cholera.
Mm-hmm.
essentially poison these parts of China as well. And so, you know, the Chinese estimates at the time were about 250,000 women and children that were killed. But, you know, the effects of that are still there today. In fact, there's a museum in that area dedicated to the victims of the bacteriological warfare the Japanese dead. So the Chinese really paid a very brutal price. Helping out the Doolittle Raiders.
Yes, I think a lot of people are not aware of that. I think that in your book you put it on a par with what happened in Nanjing back in 1937. It's incredible, absolutely incredible what was done to the locals. In the research and writing of this book, what are some of the things that stood out to you most?
You know, I think one of the things that fascinates me most about the story is just how consequential this raid really was. You know, if you really look at this one operation set against the backdrop of a war in which, you know, thousands of raids were flown and raids much, much larger than this one. You know, here you have 16 bombers and 80 men who, you know, execute this one raid, and yet it leads to horrific repercussions in China. And not only does that happen, but it also leads the Japanese to and stumble into the Battle of Midway, which ended up being a huge naval disaster for them. You know, they lose four aircraft carriers in one day, and it really shifts the balance of power in the Pacific back in favor of the United States. And so if you really look at, you know, these huge consequences of this one operation, I mean, it really, you know, it's incredible. I mean, it just shows you just, I mean, you know, in any other time, you know, in any other time in the war, you know, a single raid like this never would have triggered these things, but yet it does. It triggers, you know, one of the most famous battles of World War II. It leads to these horrific repercussions, you know, for the Chinese. And so the consequences that unfolded as a result of this raid, I think, are one of the things that really just continue to amaze me.
Now I'm going to ask you to pause from the book, and we're going to focus on you now. Now, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay. Well, I'm a recovering journalist. I was a newspaper reporter in a former life, and then I ended up as a Nieman Fellow at Harvard. During that time, I had a year out of a newsroom in which I started working on my first book. And which is about my father's story. My father was a naval officer during the Cold War. He was on an American intelligence ship that was sent into the Middle East and was then attacked by the Israelis. It led to a big sort of political firestorm in the 1960s between the United States and Israel. And so that was my first book. And then I just, you know, I really enjoyed the sort of the in-depth research and the long-form writing. And so I went on from that to write a book on the submarine war in the Pacific. Called The War Below. And then I wrote Target Tokyo and the Doolittle Raid. And I've just finished up at the end of 2016. I'm still working on the citations, a book on the Battle of Manila, February 1945. And that's when MacArthur comes back. And it's interesting. This book actually shares a lot of similarities with Target Tokyo in that it's a pretty big examination of the Japanese brutality in World War II. I mean, this is a book, you know, MacArthur, the very beginning of the war, when he's driven out of the Philippines, he vows to return. And and this is sort of the story of his quest to get back to Manila. A lot of people don't realize it, but, you know, Manila was a lot like a hometown for him. His father had captured the city during the Spanish-American War. MacArthur had served there often. He'd met his wife there. His son was born there. His mother had died there. So he had this great connection to the city, and he vowed to come back and liberate it from the Japanese. And he was convinced it would be the Japanese would abandon the city, and instead about 18,000 Japanese troops sort of holed up in it, and it became the equivalent of Fallujah in World War II. This brutal urban street fight in which thousands of civilians were caught in the middle, and a lot like what happened in the wake of the Doolittle raid, the Japanese, you know, they bayoneted them, they locked them in gymnasiums, set them on fire, a lot of just really awful atrocities. And it's a story that a lot of people don't know.
Read the book. It is truly one of the most, you know, in terms of your citations and your sources, it is extraordinary. I haven't seen anything like this in a long time. I'd like to see more. It is. So one of the things that stood out to me was the extraordinary attention that you gave to documenting your resources. And also, my understanding is that you had access to newly released resources in places like China and in Russia and elsewhere that no one else had ever had access to before. So, you know, based on that, could you tell us a little bit maybe about some of the new insights you gained and that you shared with your readers?
Certainly. You know, I mean, we're finally in a day and age where, you know, a lot of you can get access into different archives and you can go and you can visit these places. I mean, I was, for the book I'm working on now in Manila, you know, I spent a couple of weeks in the Philippines going through four or five different archives over there, working with locals. And yeah, and I think that's important when you're telling these kinds of stories in order to get sort of at all sides of them.
Yes.
I think one of the great finds we had was, you know, this is the first book that's ever published any of the documentation out of Japan's archives.
Mm.
You know, and in fact, what's amazing too is that this information survived.
Yes.
For a couple of reasons. One being that, you know, the Japanese, you know, as the war was winding down, they were going to lose. They destroyed a lot of their documentation, a lot of their records. Secondly, a lot of the records were destroyed in the firebombings of Tokyo.
Oh, yeah.
But the after-action report of the Doolittle raid, for instance, survived. And, you know, one of the most amazing things about it were the photographs included. And so, you know, on the sort of the report, they would have these about 3x3 images that would literally show the destruction caused by the raiders.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I lived in Japan. It was my first job out of college. Actually, I was an English teacher over there in junior high school. And
yeah.
Still maintain some great connections over there. And
sure.
So, you know, I was able to, you know, I don't speak Japanese, but I was able to, you know, work with a someone who did, you know, an American actually lives over there and does research and things like that, and able to, you know, hire him to go into the archives, pull these records, have them translated, get the photos scanned and things like that in order to be able to get, I think, for the first time, you know, this full comprehensive look at what the raiders accomplished. You know, and part of that is, you know, one of the things about this story too is, you know, for years and years, you know, people have always said, well, you know, the raiders hit only steel mills, only munitions factories. Well, you know, they didn't. I mean, there were women and children who were killed.
Yes.
You know, you're coming into a city as dense as Tokyo, where 100,000 people spread across, you know, each square mile, you know, and you've got no sense of zoning where you would put your munitions factories and industrial in one area, your residential elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Commercial, you had it somewhere else. You would have it all sort of mixed in together.
Yes.
You'd have an apartment building next to a chemical plant, next to an elementary school, where the difference when you're dropping a bomb of, you know, 50 feet means the difference of whether you hit a steel mill or you hit a home.
Yeah.
And, you know, there were examples of that where the Americans did, you know, they did hit schools and they did hit some of these things unintentionally, but that it did happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that's part of the story that we haven't known until now.
Yes.
So, but I think, you know, the great thing, you know, is you know, when you go and you travel and you go and you meet these people and you meet other researchers, I mean, it just makes your story that much better and that much, you know, you get the full story. And that's the critical thing that you're after, you know, 70 years later.
Indeed.
How can we tell the story as completely as possible?
As we close, I wanted to ask you if you would just share with us what you think is the lasting legacy of Jimmy Doolittle and those around him. And why do you think it's important that we remember this extraordinary raid that took place in the darkest days of World War II?
On the American side, it's going to be the audaciousness and the heroism of these guys to literally volunteer for a mission in which you're taking off, and where you're going to come down is uncertain. I think from the Chinese side, it's going to be the huge sacrifice made by so many men, women, and children.
Oh, yeah.
In the wake of this. And from the Japanese side, you're going to see not only the legacy of the barbarity executed against the Chinese, but the fallacy of their efforts to take Midway. We live in a day and age where we're sort of this great superpower, but once upon a time, you know, we were in a much different, much more precarious, much more dangerous situation.
James Scott, you are the author of Target Tokyo, Jimmy Doolittle and the Raid That Avenged Pearl Harbor. I really want to thank you very, very much, not only for writing this book, but also for sharing all of this with me. Thank you so much.
Pleasure is all mine. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for tuning in to today's Asia Today show with Jeffrey Bingham Mead, broadcasting to all four corners of the world from Radio 1490 WGCH, Greenwich, Connecticut, USA, and from WGCH.com anywhere via live global streaming over the internet. Learn more about the show at radioasiatoday.blogspot.com. All shows are archived and made freely available on podcast.com, SoundCloud, and the shows and hosts section of WGCH.com. Thank you for listening, and we thank our supporters and advertisers for making this show possible. We would like to invite you to join as an advertiser as well. As we like to say at my home in Hawaii, ahoi ho kakou. Until we meet again. We'll be back next Saturday morning, starting 10:30 a.m. Eastern Time. See you then.